You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Wendy Wright. Wendy, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you.
So Wendy, the way the show starts is with this question, which is huge. Who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities of you as a person or your labels or the things you do to start the conversation? What do we need to know?
Okay, first of all, I think the most important thing for me is that I'm a mom and a wife. I've been married for 32 years, and I've been a mom for 14 and a half years. And it's a wonderful, challenging thing to have to go through, but it's very rewarding. The second thing is that I'm a special education teacher in Lansing, New York, and I get an opportunity to work with some really wonderful children who have learned perseverance, and they have dealt with difficulties early on in their life, and through getting to work with them, I have learned how important it is to face your struggles right on, but hopefully have a good teacher or mentor to help you get through your struggles. And so those are qualities that I look for in friends and hopefully in myself.
And so, and you were saying before we came on air that you've taught for 20 years?
20 years, yes. Same district.
Same, wow. So I also sense, you know, this is in for the long haul.
Yes.
And the way you describe the years, the commitment, the sense of resilience and how it matters to you, and that seems like a sense of abiding commitment. Yeah.
Yes.
Neat. So you brought some music, and we're gonna start with Enya, May It Be. And do you want to say anything about this or just play it and we'll talk later?
We can play it first.
Yeah. Here we go.
May it be an evening star shines down upon you. May it be when darkness falls, your heart will be to
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Wendy Wright. So, Wendy, the life that you live now, what are the experiences that have helped to shape what you value now, what you aspire to do with your life now? How did you learn to come to the place that you are?
Okay, well, I had a really amazing upbringing. I was lucky to live in a rural area of Newfield, and so I had some pretty rural experiences. I had animals, and I really learned to love and value life through them. Uh-huh. At that point, when I was young, my family had cows and pigs, and I decided that I was going to be a vegetarian because I could not believe that we could decide when these wonderful animals would die, and we would know on Sunday that several of them were going on Tuesday, and I would have to feed them, and I just felt so bad.
Right, so
that helped me to really value life, all life. And from there, I went, I got married, and I moved to Florida. And so I worked in apartments, and some of the apartments were really nice. But some of the jobs I had were apartments right next to a homeless shelter. And I would see the same people trying to get jobs, and I just had so much empathy for them. I didn't have any idea how to help them. I was quite young still. So I just noticed at that point. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up coming back home up to Newfield. And my mom passed away early. And so that opened up some avenues, and I decided to go to college. And at that point, I studied special education and science. I wanted mm-hmm. to do both. And I ended up getting a degree in special education. And then I realized that the connection to science is that in special education, you take these broad ideas like reading and writing, and you break them down just like you would a scientific principle, and you teach each part. But the really special things about teaching students to read and write is it really changes their life. And so once I was teaching, I had opportunities to do more research.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that in education really is the difference. It makes a difference in their opportunities in this world. And so I just continued on that path. And then in about 2007 or 2008, email was forwarded to me to apply to go to Greece in conjunction with Cornell University. And it was kind of like an ambassadorship or a city twinning with Greece, New York. And uh-huh. so I was accepted, and there was a small group of us that went. And I was like the elementary education person. And I realized at that point it was through communication. They were so interested in what we were doing here. I visited a Greek school, and what was neat is the children there were so interested in the kids here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And by coming back, we then, as the students that I was working with, we collected a treasure box. So we picked up articles and things that we thought would represent Ithaca, New York, or Lansing at the time, and we sent them to a school in Greece. And it was just making those connections. These kids here had never really thought about Greece.
Right.
And then
right.
all of a sudden, through this experience that I brought back, they did. They learned how to make baklava. We had some uh-huh. people come and teach Greek dancing. They listened to music, all the wonderful culture. But they also loved the pictures, and they could connect to people in another part of the world. Mm. And I think that was a really amazing experience. And then from there, what else did I do? I spent a couple summers and a winter down in Costa Rica doing turtle tagging, uh-huh. Where you go on a beach, and then you when the sea turtles come in, you tag them, and it's for conservation work. And one of the things that I did while I was there during the day is I went to this local school. And in talking with the director of the school, she said, well, let me show you around. Let me show you what usually happens when Americans or other people, teachers especially, come. They look at our school and they say, oh, you need this or you need that. And she said, you know, they rarely ever ask me, what is it that I need to help my students. And that was a really important life lesson. Mm-hmm. It is so easy for me to go someplace and say, oh, well, this should be fixed or it should be this way.
Right.
And so I'm learning.
With all of our assumptions going in, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm learning to maybe ask the important question.
Sure.
How can I help? Or what would help you? Or
what do you need?
Yeah, what do you need? Is there anything you need? Perhaps you are quite content the way you are.
Yep.
You know, and so those are some
honoring
of the,
another person.
Exactly, exactly. So those are some of the things that have shaped me mm-hmm. into the person that I am now.
Neat, neat. So how did you, you said that you, in your, in you not only became a special ed teacher, but you were doing research in mm-hmm. that area. What led you to value both the practice of teaching and then doing the research about teaching?
Oh, I think it's the science background that I love so much that leads me to continue to do research and to learn about the practice. Our brains and the brains of our kids are so amazing. And all the things that influence them, from the amount of words that they're heard, that they're spoken to mm-hmm. when they're young, to the nutrition that they receive both in the school and out of the school, to just having their needs met on a regular basis, all that contributes. And so that's kind of why I continue to do research, and especially in the special education department.
And your research is documenting those needs and how they're met, or how, what
it's,
is your research?
It's, my research is just learning more about it.
Yes.
I don't publish, I haven't published anything,
sure.
but I'm reading other people's research in ways that I can help students. In my job, I work not only with students with learning disabilities, uh-huh. but also quite a few students that have autism or on the autism spectrum.
Sure.
And understanding them. I have a personal connection to a really cool guy who has autism, and it's a, as a parent and as a, an educator, I want to value what parents bring as well.
Sure.
Because they know what it's like to live with the student for most of the time. I just know the best 6 hours. So
right.
if I can learn from them and learn and take what the research tells me, perhaps I can make that connection and really help the child not only learn to read or write, but also the, some of the social parts of our world
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that make an education important.
Right, right. You mentioned in the beginning that you had the, I don't know what the word you used, but what I heard was something, you had the gift or the wonderful opportunity of growing mm-hmm. up in a rural, on a farm, basically.
Yes.
And what made that wonderful? What was that? What made that a special opportunity?
Well, I actually. So what happened was we had a house, and my dad would buy older farms and then try and fix them up. So we always had a place to live, but on the farm was my animals. So it made it special. I learned hard work. We had to do a lot of hay baling when it was 90 degrees.
Right. Right.
I also learned getting up early, you know, and going to work and doing hard work.
Right.
It has its own reward. So that helped me. But I also love just the freedom of being outside.
And how would you characterize the reward of the hard work? I mean, we share some of the same things, but mm-hmm. I'm pushing just a little bit.
How do I characterize
it? Yeah. What was the reward of hard work? Personally, how did you experience it as a reward?
Well, I didn't like it at the time, but
that's also often true.
Yeah, but what it's done is it's allowed me to work hard now, and
right.
and I think that's it. You know, so I set a goal, and the goal may be something as lofty as helping another person, or,
right.
You know, I love doing environmental work. I've been to Mexico just recently to study butterflies, and they're between 10 and 14,000 feet. So you have to hike up that way. And
right.
and actually, the hard work of getting there, you have to work hard to get there. You have to save up money. And then you get this amazing, amazing experience that is available only through hard work.
Right, right, right. And there's a kind of you're primed for resilience.
Yes.
If you've had to help support your family in a venture, whether it's a small business that you run together or a farm or a sense that you're all working together. Nobody is there for the ride.
Right. Yeah, and that's it. It's, you know, as a group, we all make it or we all don't. Right. It's not just an individual.
Right. And your standard of living goes down or goes up for everybody, depending upon how well you do.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. You said you went down to Florida, and that's where you became exposed to the whole idea of homeless people, even though they've had them here for a long time, too. But you probably noticed the first time there. What took you to Florida?
My husband, we got married, and with a lot of people, when they first get married, they think it's going to be amazing and wonderful. Well, then reality hits really quickly, and it's more of a challenge. So we decided that what we needed to do to be a better couple is to leave and depend on each other here. My husband is from Trumansburg, so we had all kinds of family influences, and we never really became ourselves. So about 6 months after we were married, we moved to Florida.
So it was your effort to grow up.
To grow up,
as
to grow
a couple
together.
And individuals.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think so. You got married right out of high school, is what I'm going to infer.
Yeah. So about when I was 20.
Yeah. And that there is a whole tradition where couples marry young and they expect to grow up together.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like they expect to arrive at that moment, but they expect to grow up together. And people, I think, when they get married later, don't realize that they're still growing up to do. Together.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and so many people told us to wait, that, you know, your marriage will never make it. And I remember hearing and thinking, no, we are going to, you know, and this is just another time that's really hard work. And it really is hard work. It is hard to compromise all the time. It is hard when I'm tired and my husband is tired to come home and not grouse at him or, you know, work. And all that stuff takes so much energy.
Right. Yeah. No. So you brought some more music with you. What should we play next?
Okay. So what shall we?
While you figure that out, I'm going to do the station ID. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Wendy Wright.
How about Mary Chapin Carpenter's I Take My Chances?
Here we go.
The tracks. I stood on the rail till I saw that train, just to see how my heart would react. Now some people say that you shouldn't tempt fate, and for them I cannot disagree. But I never learned nothing from playing it safe. I say fate should not tempt me. I take my chances. Chance I get. I sat alone in the dark one night, tuning in by remote. I found a preacher who spoke of the light, but there was brimstone in his throat. He'd show me the way according to him in return for my personal check. I flipped my channel back to CNN and I lit another cigarette. I take my chances. Yes, forgiveness doesn't come with a debt. I take my chances. I take my chances every chance I get. Of words and wire, and both have cut me deep. I've been frozen out and I've been on fire, and the tears are mine to weep. But I can cry until I laugh, or laugh until I cry. So cut the deck right in half. I'll play from either side. I take my chances. My time.
And that was Mary Chapin Carpenter, and I Take My Chances. The line goes, I take my chances, I don't cling to remorse or regret. It's funny, I normally don't ask this question until a little bit later in the interview, but since we played that song, what have you had to learn that you wouldn't have thought you would have to learn in life? What presented itself as I need to do this, you never thought you would have to?
So, what presented? Something that presented is we were lucky enough 14 years ago to be given an amazing son through adoption. And then 3 years later, my husband was diagnosed with a very rare disease. And so at that point, he was given a very short lifespan. But I couldn't believe it. You know, how do you be given this gift and at the same time be something is so important is taken away?
But threatened to be taken
away. Yeah. But for whatever reason, perhaps it's all the healthy things that he's doing and his he is still walking. We go down to Baltimore every now and then to see his neurologist, and his neurologist is always like, wow, I can't believe that you're still walking.
Uh-huh.
And that it, you know, he's just amazed. So that's something. But the thing, so that's what I never thought I'd have to face is this difficulty of balance and helping somebody that does have a degenerative disease and trying to do it well. There are many, many days I don't do it well. So,
let me just back up here. So, you were together for 18 years before you adopted.
Yes.
That's a long time. That's a huge change. It's a big decision. How did that wonderful thing come about?
How did it come about? Well, it's a friend of mine called me and told me that a friend had a child and. For certain circumstances, she no longer could keep the child.
Child. Yeah, yeah.
And knew that we had been looking. And so we made the connection.
So it's a family-to-family adoption.
Yes. And so 3 days later, he was in our house, and he's been our son ever since.
Wow. And I guess I was also, I was, and you had wanted children from this, apparently.
Yes.
And you'd waited a long time.
Well, we tried.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't get the choice.
Yeah. No, that's right. But it also, even though it is the wonder that you wait for, to have been together for 18 years and then have a child, it can change the marriage in all sorts of incredible ways that are sometimes harder than if you had them earlier in life.
Oh, yes. Yes, because we had each become individuals.
Sure.
And my husband was a fire chief at Newfield, and so he was very active in that. And I, of course, had my teaching career, and I was traveling and doing different humanitarian type of projects. And so we always laughed and said, you know, we are our best selves when we are apart. And then we would come together, you know, like on a weekend or whatever.
Sure.
And we were so happy to see each other that that time was spent. In the summer, I think we spent too much time together.
Right.
And so then it was good to spread apart. But yes, once we had our son, then of course we spent all this time together, and we had to then redevelop that relationship that, to more have a parallel relationship as opposed to each of us doing our own things and just coming together more frequently.
Right. And a continuous relationship.
Yes.
And also being being in relationship with your son at the same time.
Yes, and
not
more
necessarily
giving.
On the same page, because parents don't have to be on the same page, but they have to be respectful.
Oh, yes, and not being as selfish. I find that I tend to be a rather selfish person, and it's difficult sometimes when
What do you mean by that? Because, I mean, there's self-oriented, there's regarding the needs of the self and taking care of them, and then there's kind of letting yourself become obsessed with yourself.
No, selfish in the sense that I like things done my way and I want to do it now and impatient.
Yep.
And so, I always have to keep that in mind because I see a different way sometimes. And when you have a husband and a son and at work and children at school.
And they all have their ways.
You know, it's teaching me to... Right. That my way is not always the only way, and that I always have to keep rounding the edges of some pretty sharp corners to make it smoother.
Right. And it's, I read a quote yesterday. I was on the door of a friend's office that's to the effect that, you know, giving up control in a modern, in our current lifestyle where we try to manage so many things, giving up control is an act of suffering that we have to choose.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard.
Yeah. And so also I imagine though, the more that you have to take care of, the more you want to try to take care of it well on your terms.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, and it's not just here in Lansing. I see a broader picture. Mm-hmm. I see the world as places of tiny little pockets that perhaps I can influence.
Right. And so when your husband was diagnosed and you have a 3-year-old, how has your marriage grown? How has your relationship changed? How has it become easier and become harder?
So the way it's become easier is I value him, and he's just this amazing person who is very kind and gentle. And the way it's become harder is I am not as patient as I should be, so we grouse more than we probably should. And seeing someone that you love going through difficulty is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I admire what he does. You know, I watch it is very different than watching and going through it like my husband is going through it. So I really admire what he does and what he's able to do. So that's the hard part.
Right. And putting the pain that you experience aside so you can have the relationship that's possible.
Yes. And it's really scary. You know, it's I mean, we all know that perhaps today is our last day or tomorrow, but we don't really think about it.
In theory, we know that, yes.
You know, we live it as if, I plan this. I plan 5 years out. I'm going to be doing this.
Uh-huh.
It does make me value that I know with us, today is probably a better day for him than tomorrow will be because of the nature of his disorder.
Of the degenerative disease. Sure.
Yeah. So to try and live today.
Yes.
And I think it's a good, it's something that's hard, but it's something that's good to learn and to value.
Mm-hmm. And it's a lot. With a teenage son and his growing up with his father and you know, having to sort all that out even as all these things are happening.
Yep, he's never known my husband any other way.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes it's hard because he has uncles who are very, very active.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband used to be.
Right.
And he sees his cousins with his uncles doing things. So luckily, though, they have included my son in a lot of things. So they make him feel really good.
Right. And I imagine from what you've said that he will value some of the coping that his father has done and the wisdom that comes from that later in life.
Much more than now. Yeah, he just wrote an amazing, in fact, right before we came here, he was working on his Father's Day card, and he just wanted to go to the dollar store, and I'm like, nope, you are of an age where you need to actually write some things. And so he spent a couple hours, and it was pretty amazing what he actually could talk about, how he's on a journey with him, and right now things are rough and bumpy, but that they're on a journey together, and that he knows about respect, even though he doesn't always respect him now.
Right.
But in the future, he surely hopes to, and that he, you know, he's an example. So it was pretty. I was all teary eyed when I was reading it.
Yes.
So I'm sure my husband will be excited tomorrow to get something so heartfelt.
Wow. My father died unexpectedly when my older brother was 15, and had just turned 15, and they were in that bumpy space, and and but they had not had the opportunity to articulate that. Mm. And I was seven, so I was much in a different space.
Right.
But that, and since this show airs initially on Father's Day, I think it's lovely to note those things.
Yes.
We're going to play Lives in the Balance.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Wendy Wright. So Wendy, I am kind of, well, not kind of, what has given you the sense of engagement with the world and curiosity about the whole world that sends you off on these service trips, mm-hmm. and sends you off into different places, and now you're about to go to Greece to a refugee camp just north of Athens to serve for a couple of weeks this summer. What about your life has helped to make this? Where did you get the bug, or where did it come from inside?
I think that where it came from inside is when I was in second grade. I had this amazing second grade teacher, and Harriet Souther. She was a Newfield principal. She's still around. Mm-hmm. Occasionally run into her, and she was my inspiration. I remember her coming. She had been in the Peace Corps, and she wore this Moroccan necklace, and she had the most magnificent clothes. This would have been, 72, 73, so you can imagine. Uh-huh. She looked pretty amazing, and she made us couscous, and one day she just played this music, and I thought, oh my gosh, I want to be just like that. I want to do those types of things. And so it was really a second grade teacher that did that. And then just through life experiences, being here in Ithaca, I try to take as many advantage of as many opportunities as I can to go up to listen to different speakers from sure. around the world to get a perspective. I think hearing other people's perspective and trying to understand where other people are coming from mm-hmm. is so important. I mean, we all want the basics. We all want to be safe and eat and raise a family. And that being the core, what else shapes us? And it's listening to other people's stories and just realizing that although there are differences, you know, it's that core thing that brings us together for humanity mm-hmm. and just the pure excitement. I mean, our world is so amazing, and each country has a different history. And as I learn more about history, you know, you understand how it's all interconnected. And I guess it's just through that interconnection of meeting people and talking.
Sure. So how did this trip to the refugee camp in Greece come about?
So it was really quite amazing. Actually, on Thursday, so this is kind of the roundabout way. On Thursday, I leave for Japan on a two-week peace study tour. I had been taking classes through five colleges in the National Consortium for Teaching About Asia, and I was finished, and then my professor emailed me back and said, hey, would you be interested in going for a couple weeks this summer with some of the other people from sure. around that had been taking these courses? Let me know. And I'd always been interested in peace, and so of course I responded. And at the same time, I got this email from Cross Cultural Solutions, and I hadn't ever worked with them. Mm-hmm. And it said, like, are you interested in peace studies? And I had assumed that it had something to do with the Japan trip. So I opened up the email, and it was this interest that said, you know, are you interested in helping Syrian refugee women and children? And I thought, that has been on my heart for a long time. I've been watching a lot about it. I've been trying to learn to understand the conflict more. I learned about, like, the White Helmets, who are people, White Helmet Brigade, who are people that have donated their lives almost. Many of them, they go in after a bombing and they dig out people, no matter what their ethnicity or political stances. Sure. They just help people. And then I was just amazed at the amount of people, women especially, who had to be strong because they were missing husbands, fathers, brothers. And they were taking these trips from Syria. Either they could go to Jordan, or some of them were actually getting in the lifeboats and then going over to Greece.
Right.
And so that's how I got interested. That's how I heard about the trip. Mm-hmm. And I also remember when I was in Florida, that was during the Haitian
sure.
Boat time where the yep. Haitians were coming on shore. And I just remember the anger with the people and saying, you know, go back. And they were angry with the Haitian people for coming to the United States. And I didn't know what to do. I mean, I happened to be on a beach that we were, again, doing turtle tagging. And I couldn't believe, you know, would I ever dare go out into an ocean in a rickety boat with my family? No. I mean,
well, if you didn't have anything but death behind you,
that's
you might.
Right. Yeah. You know, to be able to be able to take that chance, you know, things are that desperate. And so I keep thinking to myself, you know, perhaps there's a small thing that I can do to help relieve some pain for these people. And also, when I was in Mexico just in February, I ran into a lot of people, and they kept asking me, the question was, why do you dislike us so much? And this, of course, was in reference to the wall. And yep. There were a lot of jokes, you know, I hope your plane can make it over the wall and you can get back. But really what stuck with me is, why do you dislike us? And I thought, I don't. Many, many, many Americans don't. Right. And so perhaps by going and showing people that there are people from America, and of course there'll be many other Americans that'll go there, and show them that we really care about right. you. You are not forgotten people.
So you're showing up.
I'm there. Showing up.
And are you taking things for, are there things you're taking with you for the refugees, or are they pretty well supplied? Or?
We are really not supposed to bring anything.
Okay.
However, a good friend of mine's husband lives in Pakistan, and he has brought 50 soccer balls from Pakistan here to the United States, and they're in a suitcase, and I'm going to take the suitcase to Greece with me, and I have some paperwork so I can get it through immigration and to give it to the kids that are there
sure.
because they have a soccer team.
Sure, sure. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. What will you be doing in the camps, or do you know yet?
It's not definite, but hopefully we will be working on infrastructure. Right now, most of it is tents. There are a few container houses,
yeah, yeah.
But there's no real roads or there's no sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are some people there that have disabilities, physical disabilities. So hopefully I can help create some ramps and that type of thing.
Sure.
I'm an okay builder. I don't
right.
do it a lot.
Right.
So I will be doing that. Just playing.
One of the skills of growing up on a farm is you know how to make things.
Yes.
Or how to figure it out.
That's yeah. even more important. I hope to just be able to maybe watch some children so the moms can be together and doing whatever it is that they need to do so they can have some communal time together
sure.
with moms. Playing with the older children is nice. I don't speak their language, but it's that universal language of smiling and just kind of playing
and
physical play.
Yeah, yeah.
There's, of course, food distribution, cleaning, you know, the more mundane
sure.
things. And that's also very valuable. And I'm really good at stuff like that.
Yeah.
If you just tell me to go clean that or go do that job, I'm totally fine behind the scenes.
Yeah. And I think for people who are in need to be served in a way like that without expectation
yeah.
is a much more powerful gift.
Yeah. I don't expect to get from them. It is truly
yeah.
about giving to them for whatever it is that they need.
Right.
Though, you know, it would be neat if I end up being able to talk to somebody in English, you know, and make that connection.
And
that would be just an amazing opportunity.
And many Syrians also speak English, or
exactly.
at least some English.
Yeah.
They've studied it. So yes. Yes, and my understanding. So I'm gonna. You have arranged with Cultivare
mm-hmm.
to have a fundraiser to help send you and two colleagues, Jeanette Luther and
Megan McVeigh,
to serve in this refugee camp. And this fundraiser takes place on the 22nd of June, and it's a meal to help with expenses.
Yes.
From 5 to 8 at Cultivare. Is there any contact information where people could go to find out more about this?
Well, they're more than welcome to call the restaurant.
Right.
There's a lot of information there, or they can contact me.
And what is your email address?
My email is wright@lcsd.k12.ny.us.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
It's wright@lcsd,
and it stands for Lansing Central
School
district.k12.ny.us.
Okay, okay. If people want more information about that, they can get it there.
Yes.
Let's take a quick let's go to Sound of Silence.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains.
the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, 'neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light. It split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never shared. No one dared disturb the sound of silence. Fool said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my words like silent raindrops fell and echoed silence. And the people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made. And the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, tenement halls.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Wendy Wright. So Wendy, the way we close the show is to learn a little bit about how have you learned to take care of yourself. What do you do to renew, restore, to right the ship intellectually, emotionally, physically, and how do you know you need to do it?
Okay. So, I think the first thing I think I'll talk about is I have a great faith, and my faith is really what is my guiding principle. And the principle of faith that I try to think about the most is to love. Mm-hmm. And love takes so many different forms, but to love each other. And so through that, that is one of the principles. So attending church mm-hmm. is one way that I am spiritually kept renewed and happy. Mm-hmm. Physically, geez, I'm not so good at that. I used to be a runner and trail runner, but what I still love doing is just being outside. There's so much positive feelings that I get, and just being settled, being outside. Right. And I can see the complexity of our world, and it's just renewing to know every year, like I go to the same place, I have the same hike, and I see the same things growing. And that the knowing that it does renew, and that there's always a chance to make it better. Mm-hmm. It mm-hmm. comes around again. So if it's not quite what we want, it will come again.
Right. You mentioned the word faith, mm-hmm. and the historic meaning of that word is hope and trust. Mm-hmm. And that is the sense in which you used it. And a lot of people either don't use it that way, or more often they don't hear it that way. They hear mm-hmm. it as belief or projection or dogma. But you're using it in the hope and trust sense. And what confirmed it was your reliance on the word love, mm-hmm. which I take it from all that you've said in this hour is to see the wholeness or the fulfillment of others and yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And that posture means that you engage with a kind of confidence, or mm-hmm. and lived expectation.
Yes, I always try to tell my son, especially when he was growing up, that he was in a safe place, mm-hmm. And that 99% of the people are wonderful people. You know, mm-hmm. that stranger danger, I've told him he doesn't really need to worry so much about that, that really strangers are people that have something in common with us that we haven't met yet as right. a friend.
And it's not the stranger we should be sensitive to. It's when something isn't going in a way that feels right.
That's right.
That's when we should be yep, sensitive.
Yeah, it's not yes. Yeah. And that's exactly it. So I do. I have great faith in people and that there's goodness in so many people.
Right. So you lead with trust.
Yes.
And then we figure out what we can do or not do mm-hmm. together.
Yes. And is this a scary journey? Yeah, this is really scary. I mean,
yes.
Yeah, I don't know how it'll end. I'm hoping positively, but yeah, you just yeah. never know.
And while we were off air, you were saying that some of your family doesn't understand why you're doing this.
Yeah, I have my brother and sister are quite supportive, and I do have some family members that they just don't understand. You know, here I have a husband that it would be wise to stay with. And a son who's in some pretty formative years. And here I am carting off to another part of the world when there's the need right here in my own home. And what I say to them is that my husband is so supportive. He often will say, you know, in a couple of years, maybe I will be able to go with you, or perhaps next year this is something that I can embark on with you as well. He totally supports what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. He thinks that, again, people are wonderful. And he has grown as well and really wants to help in many ways. Like I had said, he was a firefighter, so he has that mentality as well.
A service
to help
orientation.
And help people. And he's still very active and tries to help.
What do you think the fear is, or are people feeling like you are not doing what's most important, or are they afraid for your well-being?
It's not my well-being that they're afraid of. It's the fear of the unknown for me, I think, is what they are worried about. You know, the thought that I occasionally, when there's an opportunity, I volunteer through Ithaca Welcomes Refugees. There's a lot of fear that, you know, we'll just open the border and let all these people in. I don't know who these people are. These people are people that just like us and them that want the same things in life.
Right.
So I think that's what it is, you know. And they're afraid, especially like some of my not immediate family, I think they're afraid of what they see as the future, because they don't have the skill base to find employment and to continue with that employment. And they're so afraid that somebody will take something from them
right.
that for whatever reason, simply because they were born here in the United States, they should have and others shouldn't.
Right.
You know, it really is a crapshoot where you're born.
Right. And we can't choose where we're born.
Where we're born.
And I grew up in something resembling a rural ghetto, and there were not a lot of opportunities, and the farms were consolidated and mechanizing, and they didn't need people. And that meant that drugs were rampant, mm-hmm. Alcoholism was rampant, fights with the police were rampant, the healthcare was lousy. And 1 out of 20 of my peers wouldn't make it to 20.
Yeah.
And that sets up a kind of a level of fear of things and not knowing how to engage, especially if you don't have people like yourself who are willing to kind of make some of those relationships happen. But if people are set against it, they have a hard time realizing it. There was an article in the Times recently that talked about American-born youth are twice as likely as undocumented youth to get in trouble with the law. Mm-hmm. And three times as likely as legal immigrants to get in trouble with the law. So it's the U.S.-born youth that are creating the problems in certain ways. And we just don't think about it that way.
No.
We've kind of let children grow up feral to some extent here.
Yeah. And where everybody often is, you know, when gets the blue ribbon, everyone is wonderful. Sometimes I look at things and opportunities for kids to not make it difficult for them, but to not always win. What does it feel like to not always win? And to really work hard for things. Well, a lot of the immigrant families have, they have that mentality because they've already lived that. They are living that right now.
Right. And if each generation grows up with a full awareness of the challenges we need to face to sustain ourselves and the world around us, there are plenty of challenges. It's just when we turn away and look at our own personal consumption and whether we're happy with what we have and what we possess and what we can get.
Right.
I'm sorry, this is my sermon for today. I will have to stop on that.
No worries. No, I'm
so and I'm going to say I've inferred from what you were saying about your you study everything. So intellectually, that's a daily sort of thing.
Oh, I do.
Emotionally, is kind of the faith community piece and the friends through that. And physically, the walking and used to be the running. And I imagine just there's if your husband's having mobility issues, you got physical care issues too.
Yes.
And that's a lot.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. He does a great job of taking care of himself. He's doing a lot of Pilates, so I'm trying to encourage that. He's got a wonderful partner that he walks with and then has a good spiritual conversation they're walking and stuff. So that's very positive. Yeah. But it is a hard, it is challenging. I've got lots of challenges, but I guess I get renewed. The biggest renewal is at about 3:30, my son walks up from the middle school and comes, and he's like, "Hey, Mom, how's your day?" Every day, no matter even if we had the worst day in the world, that is his opening line. And that is so renewing. But I also get that from my students. Some of the most difficult students will be like, "Hey, Mrs. Wright, you know, I don't know, you know, how's your day?" Or they'll give me a hug. And these are fourth grade boys who, you know, are not
often. They can make it hard for you.
Yes, they can, you know, and yet they'll be so kind. And that is just so rewarding, more than, you know, more than any amount of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you want to close with Ode to Joy.
Ode to Joy, absolute favorite.
And it seems like you know how to stand in the hurt. To hold the joy.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been, Wendy, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you very much.